Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 28th, 2005. Today's session is a forum on living as nonviolent people, facilitated by Deanne Lagerquist. Disc number FO-2005-18.
Nonviolence, philosophy, and practice, a topic much at the center of many things at Holden Village, and we have three people who will help us launch our conversation. I'm going to let each of them say something about themselves. Carolyn, Peter, and Aesop. Carolyn is going to start by introducing a 12-minute video, and then Peter will speak maybe 5 minutes, and then Aesop, and then we'll open the floor for conversation. So, Carolyn?
Just to introduce myself, Carolyn Scherer. I'm from Minneapolis. There I'm a member of the community of St. Martin, many of whom take a vow of nonviolence. And as part of my striving for including nonviolence as part of my lifestyle, I volunteer one day a week at the Nonviolent Peace Force, which has its administrative offices in Minneapolis. And I'm not going to speak about it other than just introduce it, but we'll have a film that will give you the idea of it. But because I'm very hopeful that more people than just those in Minneapolis and some of the other centers begin to learn about this, there is a brochure here, either for yourself or to pass on to someone else, that I'll have back here so you can pick one up as you leave. The whole idea of the Nonviolent Peace Force in the brief motto is, what can you say yes to when you say no to war? As many people might be against war, but then what do you say yes to? And this began in 1999, actually, in The Hague. There was a peace forum, a large gathering, international gathering, and Mel Duncan from Minneapolis was one of those in attendance, as was David Hartshu, who is in California. And Mel Duncan, after having been there for quite a few days of it, was speaking to his wife and saying he was so tired of just listening, and nothing ever happening. And she says something to him like, then it's time for you to make something happen. And it just happened at the same time David Hartshu was having many of the same thoughts, and they became the directors and the founders of this movement, which is an international movement. Its actual international headquarters is in Belgium, in Brussels. Its administrative office is in Minneapolis. And the attempt to have a force for peace with as much concern and dedication and effort as the force we put into the military forces. It's an international movement. The first team is now at work in Sri Lanka. They are trained, they are paid, they are sent out for 2 years. Of the first group who went out, I believe there's something like 12 of them that are re-enlisting, if you want to call it that, to continue for another 2 years as the second team goes out. So it has begun, it is international in scope. Many of the peace laureates have given up their backing, and it is an attempt to offer an alternative to military, and it begins only in regions where they are asked to come in. So while they have started in Sri Lanka, they are also considering the possibility of the Philippines, of Israel-Palestine, and I believe Uganda as other possibilities. So we'll let the film clip speak for itself, but later on if you have questions, and encourage you to pick up one of these.
The Nonviolent Peace Force is the gift our grandchildren are asking of us.
La Fuerza Internacional de Paz es una herramienta de reflexión.
The way of making
so we have here an example of nonviolence in practice, of participating actively in an alternative to violence and war. Peter, you want to give us some philosophical context?
Yeah, Carolyn brought up now.
Carolyn and Aesop, you want to come and sit up here and get the rest of the lights on? So, what have I missed?
One thing that might, oh, I'm sorry. Peter Thompson, I'm working on ops. I've practiced law in Minneapolis for a long time, and now I'm in seminary. And I did a lot of civil disobedience lawyering, worked for peace activist people. The question might occur to you when you watch that, or you think about nonviolence in general, is, does it work? And the reason that question probably occurs to you is we never hear anything about nonviolence. We aren't taught about nonviolence. It isn't part of history. If you think of the way you were taught history in high school, it's about from war to war to war. So you learn about, you know, how we've resolved or tried to resolve conflicts in the last century. Well, in thinking about does nonviolence work, I think we have to talk about two things. First, has violence worked? And secondly, are there instances where it appears that nonviolence has worked? So there is at least some indicators that give us hope that it should be given a chance. As to the first question, I think it's pretty apparent from all of our experiences that this century has primarily been about war and death and destruction. We went from the war to end all wars, and about the time people were just starting to recover from that, World War II started, and then of course the Korean War started, and then the Cold War started, and then the Bosnian War occurred, and then the Gulf War occurred. As we're sitting here right now, there are many conflicts around the world. There are 30 that are designated major. That is, 1,000 people or more have been killed in those conflicts. Sri Lanka has 60,000 so far. So we have to find a way to settle conflict. There's always going to be conflict between human beings. And it has been established beyond, as a criminal lawyer, beyond a reasonable doubt that war doesn't work. Now, when I was on the Resource Center here, one time I got a letter from a woman, and we were doing a lot of peace things around the war on terrorism. And she wrote a letter and she said, yeah, I was just up at Holden, I was very angry. They were talking about peace all the time. It's a good thing we have brave leaders in Washington, because all you do is talk about peace and pray and you don't do anything else. Well, pray is probably a pretty good intervention, but in the North American mindset, the Western scientific way of thinking, we want a little more proof. Well, think about the last 50 years. During World War II, in Denmark, in Norway, and in France, there were successful and wonderful nonviolent interventions. Some of these that I'll mention were big, some were little. So, you know, some were ended by violence, some continue legacies today, but it's really undeniable that there are a lot of strategies. And it's funny that probably for a lot of us, this is one of the first specific strategies we've ever heard about. And I won't go through in detail of all of them, because I've been allotted only 5 minutes, because this is a big topic. But you remember Denmark, there was a 17-year-old boy on a bicycle, and he got the idea, and he talked the king into putting on a yellow star, and the Jews were not identified. In Norway, a group of teachers held out, and they refused to change their curriculum to the Nazi curriculum in the schools, and there was enough broad-based, spontaneous support among the citizenry that the Nazis gave up. In France, in La Chambon, there was largely a Lutheran community that did this wonderful refugee work, and it was so supported by that community and the surrounding communities, they saved hundreds, if not thousands, of Jews, that the Germans knew it was going on. It was very public. And they felt they couldn't do anything because too many people were against it. They finally arrested the Lutheran pastor who was the head of the whole movement. And a few months later, he had such a following from both his community and the people in the concentration camp, they released him. You know, if he was a Jew, they would have killed him, no doubt, but they released him. There was just a little thing in World War II. Guatemala and El Salvador in the middle 40s. Had totally nonviolent revolutions and changed their governments. In 1947, India won independence from Britain, fourth largest country in the world, by a nonviolent means. See, we don't put all these things together as being the force of potential of nonviolence. In 1968, Czechoslovakia walked away from the Soviet Union nonviolently. The people in Iran in 1978 got rid of the Shah of Iran without a drop of blood. Now, subsequently, some fundamentalists have taken over, what have you. But in 1989, think of this. You never think of this as nonviolence. In 1989, the Soviet Union, one of the two superpowers of the world, collapsed without any blood. And in the most dramatic event there was two very dramatic events. One was Solidarity in Poland, which was started around the labor movement, and the people joined, and the Soviets gave up. The other was against Erich Honecker, who was probably the most despotic of the dictators in East Germany. And the people started fomenting disagreement in the streets. And he had been the most iron-fisted person of all, and he ordered his Secret Service to go out and shoot the people, and they refused. And a couple days later, he was arrested and the Berlin Wall was coming down. And this was something the CIA hadn't even imagined was possible, at least in the, you know, in the foreseeable future. So there are then South Africa ended apartheid. Martin Luther King, without any violence, got the Civil Rights Act passed, and some huge changes happened in our country. So there are many, many examples of the force and the efficacy of nonviolence. So next time someone says, well, by turn the other cheek, you mean you're just supposed to do nothing and sit there and be passive? Pacifism is not passivism. It can be very active, just like these people putting their life on the line every day to create a space so people can solve their own conflicts. So not only has war disproven itself as the way to end conflicts, and we should try another way, but nonviolence has given us indications and has proven it can be efficacious. It might not always work in every circumstance. Nonviolent Peace Force has some very strict parameters as to where they're going to go and where they're going to jump in. You know, they need a broad-based group of people there to invite them in. So, but it's been studied. It's been studied by many people in peace studies groups, if some of you take those kinds of things in school, and it needs to be recognized, and we have to start doing something else. The atomic bomb made it the most obvious, because now every conflict, as this showed, civilians are the main victims of war. Look at Iraq today, you know, in the newspaper every day. It's civilians. And so we have to go about this a different way. When Bush says we're going to win, think of what winning means and what will it produce in a lasting way. The Soviets won World War II. They had 20 million people were killed. That's not a win. So you don't have winners. There's a new book out, Fred, you were mentioning it the other day. Every war has two losers. There aren't really winners, and nonviolence can be win-win situations built on respect and reconciliation and viewing the other as your brother or sister, as Christ comes.
Thanks, Peter Vesa. Would you say something about yourself first?
My name is Asaph Murfin. We're finishing our second year at Holden. I'm the person responsible. We're finishing our second year here at Holden. I'm the person responsible for repair in the village. A little of my history. In the late 60s and early 70s, during the time of the Vietnam War, I was just really attracted by the countercultural movement that started then, this whole notion of peace and love and, you know, we're against the war, and got fairly involved in that movement. And after the war ended, we felt, of course, those of us felt we were part of that movement felt like this would just spread and take over the world. But obviously, that didn't quite happen. But after the war ended, I spent about 8 years in an intentional community, getting some experiences very similar to some of the things we experienced living here at Holden. in about 2000, my wife and I started attending a Church of the Brethren, which is one of the three historic peace churches. Mennonites, Quakers, and the Brethren are really from the 16th century, I believe, have been the only churches consistently against violence. So we joined that church, and at that time, I didn't really know that much about them. I liked the church. I liked that they were a peace church, and I liked the people. But I've had some opportunity then to study the churches and what that really means. And I just want to give a really, really brief history of the peace in the Christian churches. The first three centuries of Christianity, all Christians were pacifists. They would not join the Roman military. They suffered for that. And it wasn't until Emperor Constantine became a Christian and basically incorporated Christianity into the state that we started to see the just war theory brought into play, and church and state have marched hand in hand through almost all the rest of history up till now. Even in this country, I think the major denominations are pretty plugged into our state, and we can see the results. There are very few Christians that really would argue that war is sin. I happen to believe that it is. I wanted to just read a very brief statement by an early Quaker in 1676. Robert Barclay wrote this: "Whoever can reconcile this, resist not evil, with resist evil by force. Again, give also thy other cheek with spoil them, make a prey of them, pursue them with fire and sword, or pray for those that persecute you with persecute them by fines, imprisonment, and death itself. Whoever can find a means to reconcile these things may be supposed also to have found a way to reconcile God with the devil, Christ with the Antichrist, light with darkness, and good with evil." Last year, at the end of winter, the winter community felt strongly they wanted to do something, make some kind of a statement of our feelings about the ongoing war in Iraq. And so throughout the summer, last year, 2004, we did weekly what we call the Iraq Vespers. And that was generally about 10 minutes at the beginning of the Vesper service, where we would darken the VC. You can see the little boxes are still up on the railing. So they had candles about every 2 inches all the way around three sides of the VC. And we would light those candles. And then as a litany was read, which basically talked about the relationships of people who had died, mothers, fathers, uncles, aunts, friends, we would put out those candles until they were all dark, each candle representing about 50 people at that point who had died. And it was a pretty powerful experience for me, and one I'm hoping we'll do occasionally this summer. This year, a little earlier in the spring, we studied and discussed nonviolence, and a number of villagers signed a commitment to nonviolence. It was a one-year commitment, and we actually did it right here in Fireside. And that's an ongoing discussion, and there will be more, I think, opportunities for people to join that. So the discussion's ongoing here at Holden.
So now we open the floor for your comments and participation. If you have questions you'd like to ask, of course, Carolyn and Peter and ASAP are happy to respond to those. The idea of a forum is that it's not Q&A so much as conversation around the room. Yes?
I have a question. Is anybody here familiar with nonviolent communication? Marshall Rosenberg?
Maybe you could say something
about it. If I could share a little bit, I might refer to some things that got written here. But basically, he was a clinical psychologist who, in his practice, was seeing the role that language plays in promoting violence in terms of labeling, diagnosing, whatever, blaming, all that, and the role that that plays in creating violence among humans. And he talks a lot about human relations and having nonviolence in human relations and being non-judgmental. He then, bit of a summary here, he felt that the only way to get peace in the world is to work on our language and stop blaming, that kind of thing. And so he has first used nonviolent communication in federally funded projects United States for, first of all, mediation for racial segregation schools where racial segregation is going on. And then he's also done a lot with, in the war-torn countries, Israel, Palestine, Sri Lanka, Croatia, Colombia. In 1985, he started the Center for Nonviolent Communication. And now he does a lot of work in schools, prisons, government agencies. And I've been practicing nonviolent communication for the past year. There's a lot of things going on in prisons, which is very powerful in terms of the use of the language and talking with prisoners to help them get to the bottom of why they do the kinds of things that they, what they have done. So anyway, I don't know if anybody has any other questions about it, but I've just seen that as a real strong means, similar to the Peace Force one. And anybody that wants more information about that can see me. But, you know, it's a combination of one-to-one human relations, but also pretty powerful in other ways.
Where and how do you practice it?
What it is you get some training on nonviolent communication, and then you join a practice group, and it's just basically talking about, at first I had a real hard time with it. It was like kind of affective listening, you know, if somebody's upset about something, or, you know, like I'm not sure what kind of thing to give an example of. You can use it in personal family relationships, in terms of just affective listening. It looks like that's a really important thing to you. Are you feeling frustrated because you weren't listened to? That's just some examples of it. So getting at feelings and needs, helping people get at feelings and needs, and kind of like there's a phrase, it's not about me, it's all about you. And so that understanding, it comes to really understanding where the other person's coming from, setting yourself aside, and understanding where that, what feelings and needs, unmet needs that are, what's going on for that person in terms of unmet needs, and helping them get to understand their feelings, and then and giving them empathy as needed so they can go on with their life. So in a practice group, you go around and just practice using communication terms. It's hard to explain. Sorry, I'm not doing a very good job explaining it.
I have two questions, one for Carolyn and one for Ted. So, and you may not be able to address this one, but I thought it was interesting that who was not listed on the list of sponsors affiliated with the Nonviolent Peace Organization, and that was the Fellowship of Reconciliation. It seemed a conspicuous absence. I mean, you may not know anything about that, but. And then my second question to ASAP is, I'm curious about more of the deep content of the commitment to nonviolence that the Winter Community made, the specifics about that.
Carolyn, why don't you go first, and then Peter can answer with this too, because he's very familiar with it. Also, I think this movie basically names some individuals like Nobel laureates and so on, but there's many, many, many organizations, and I think they didn't make any attempt to list them. I personally know people who are members of Fellowship of Reconciliation and strongly support this. I'm guessing they probably are one of those groups, but I don't know.
Yeah, they are. There's 93 member organizations around the world, and FOR is one of the main supporters.
Okay.
That was simple.
I think rather than butchering it by trying to remember the details, is we should get a copy of it and post it somewhere. Is there one posted out there?
It was right at the door for a little while.
Part of the problem is I haven't signed the one that we worked on because it had, as a parting statement, a fairly theological statement that really wasn't really my theology, and it didn't really have anything to do with the commitment. And so I felt, a lot of us felt it was a little funny in that we were going to put out another one that didn't have that, and it hasn't happened yet. So I don't have one of my own that I read a lot or anything.
Well, I guess, I'm wondering if it sort of tries to encompass a daily life component, is in addition to sort of a larger activism against war kind of thing. Because it just seems like there's so much violence that happens in our daily lives, partly because of the culture that we have assimilated, we internalize, we don't recognize it. And so I just was curious if it was...
As I recall, it's really, it for 1 year we promise to attempt to just remove violent reactions from the way we do things in our thinking and our speaking, just at a personal level. And I think for some people, like even for myself, even though I've been involved, you know, for years in anti-war things, the somebody asking me to sign on a dotted line that for 1 year I will not, you know, I will really not be violent in any way is actually a step beyond where I've gone. So it's kind of an interesting point. It's one thing to talk about, it's something else to actually sign on.
Yeah, I mean, I see it in people's perspectives, you know, like just spiders, you know? I mean, so, and I see that as like one of the precursors of violence towards other creatures is that we feel at liberty to kill things that are inconvenient to us. And so, anyway, I was just curious about the
I was just, I write to a death row inmate, and I was just writing to him today, and I was kind of wrestling with this thing about this commitment and my fear that, you know, it's one thing to talk about doing it, but if you're, let's say, your family or your friends are under threat and you're in a position to violently protect them, if I were in that position, I really don't have this firm commitment that I would be able to be nonviolent. You know, it really comes down at that point to praying that God would step in, you know, and make me do the right thing. So it's kind of an ongoing conversation in my mind.
I hear maybe three layers of things going on here. One is about the origin of one's commitment. It is, I'm saying, that theological statement is not the origin of your commitment. So there's, where do these commitments come from? Commitments that are about personal relationships and daily life, and then involvement in larger movements. So you might think about, you know, you might be thinking about how those go together. When I saw all the different people involved in this nonviolent peace force, I wondered how much commonality of philosophy or the origins of a philosophy there might be, and where the, how those differences are negotiated. That's part of the training.
I'm curious. I have a question about nonviolent peace force. Is this another instance? I'm very familiar, well, not familiar with this at all, but I'm very familiar with Christian peacemaker James CPT, and I'm wondering, is this just another instance of the same impulse? I mean, how do, there are a number of groups that go and put themselves in harm's way nonviolently to try and protect innocent people, and this seems like much of that same kind of impulse.
Let me remind you that there are people all the way up in a project.
Oh, yes. And I'm a little plugged up, too.
Okay.
Certainly they resonate with those groups, and wherever they might be in an area, they would use each other's expertise and so on. One of the things that I see different is the ongoing commitment to most of the groups you're referring to, I think, are pretty much voluntary, volunteer. These are paid peace workers who have been highly trained, paid. They are being looked after and cared for. In quite a number of cases, some of them have families left at home. Certainly there are even wives and husbands where one has stayed behind while the other one is there, but to provide them with insurance even and their needs and so on. So it is a, and it also is an international commitment, and it is not based on one specific, like Christian or this or that. So that is one of the major differences. You want to add, Peter?
No, that's good, I think. Yeah, it's very important to the peace force that it be non-connected to any governments or any creeds or any religions or any, you know, nationalities, that it be, you know, truly an international effort. Mm-hmm. Well, going along
with that, Peter, when you started out kind of reminding us of the history of some of the success of the nonviolent movement, which we're all probably aware of, but it gets so suppressed and feels so overwhelming at times. That was just heartening, just that little bit there. And so I was thinking, how can we keep reminding ourselves that this is a viable thing, that this is a doable thing, and it can be successful. Not all the times, like you say, but certainly it can be successful. But, you know, and in our journals, in our newspapers, how can we get that out when we're getting even less than we used to? But I think that's so important. Along with what you were saying about media and the violence, there's an Institute for Media and the Violence in Minneapolis. David Walsh is the head of that. And he has done a lot of institutes and training on, for parents and teachers and everything about the impact of violence in the media on our children and on ourselves. And he's even taken on now the video games, which are, I've watched just a few of them and they're horrific. But it just makes it feel so natural, you know, that that's part of life. We have to keep reminding ourselves that's anti-life.
Yeah, it's so ingrained, you know, in our culture and in our societies and in, you know, the way we respond. I mean, I was having this long debate with my older brother, who is a wonderful person, despite the fact he's a raptor of Republican, which is like, and, you know, we got to a point, it was the run-up to the war, and he was saying, basically took the position, someone has to do it, you know, and so since we can do it, you know, we have to do it. Whereas the other way to look at it is there an alternative? And there are almost always alternatives, you know. And we've all felt that. I remember during the Bosnia War and the ethnic cleansing was going on. You know, I was just thinking, well, if we dropped a couple bombs, maybe that would stop. And of course, we finally did.
You thought that?
Yeah. I mean, I was just desperate. I mean, I was sitting there watching the news every day and watching this. You know, what was the message from World War II? Never again.
Right.
And there it was happening. Right. And we get daily reports, you know, about these horrible, you know, crimes against humanity. And immediately the default thing is, you know, let's use violence, as opposed to, are there alternatives? Are there other things we can do? And, you know, five or six of them have come up right here tonight. I mean, Nonviolence Peace Force is just one amongst, you know, innumerable ideas that people can have to resolve conflict without violence. So, I mean, we need to shift education, we need to shift the way we think, we need to shift, you know, our economics is a huge thing, you know, our ecology. I mean, you need to shift, to really see the other person as yourself, as a brother and sister, is a huge shift.
You know, and as horrific as it is that the vast majority of victims of war are civilians and innocents, those are the very people that are going to be making these changes, and this may mobilize people around the world rather than, well, it's just military, it's just soldier fighting soldier. It's a little easier to discount, whereas you have many more children and innocent people, or I guess everyone's innocent, but civilians. That's a huge mobilizing potential around the world.
And also recognizing that soldier fighting soldier today often means children fighting children.
Yes.
With all of these.
Yeah, we forget that.
And who are our soldiers right in this conflict now?
Yeah.
I mean, there's nobody from Congress, there's probably nobody from this room, or very few. You know, it's the economically coerced. They're offering $30,000 for people to re-up, you know, to go do a second year, and $30,000 to a lot of those people is a fortune.
And they're now trying to cut people's benefits coming out of the military, so, which is a big motivation for so many people going into the military.
The insidious recruiting that, the advertising that the young people who want to go to war, and that they show the parent talking them out against it. So now they're heading after the parent. It's a real bonus for your son to be able to go to war. Mm-hmm. And the advertising is just incredible.
And a lot of parents who didn't get involved before are really getting involved, trying to keep ROTC out of high schools and things like that, mm-hmm. now that this is happening.
There's been some success, too. There was in Seattle. I was on NPR a few weeks back. Was it Garfield High School?
Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, you know, the trade-off is they lose all this funding, but they were... I guess it wasn't, you know, even there it wasn't, you know, 100% thing, but the majority of the people on the PTA.
Well, we just found out for the past 3 years they've been profiling 16 to 18 year old people in school, and they just admitted a month ago that they've been violating the privacy law. But profiling them on economics, education, ethnicity, I mean, it's just so...
Bill, who is the they in this sentence?
Apparently, the Department of Defense has contracted with a private agency to do this. And they're profiling them as a means of recruiting, because they know who the most apt people to go after. So
and
it's a marketing tool.
If you don't want your kids to be one of the targets, you have to proactively go to the school and have their name removed. Because if you don't take the initiative, their name is automatically given to the recruits.
But we didn't know about it until a month ago.
Well, it used to be that ROTC helped pay for a college education. I have a nephew that went through that and then went into the Air Force afterwards. And if he hadn't gotten that help from the ROTC, he would have had a hard time getting his college degree. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Now they want to
start
someone in high school.
One of the good experiences I've had, I mean, starting with the bad experience of feeling like, you know, it's just a bunch of little people fighting this huge, just intractable beast. The good experience is that things I've been involved with, like tax resistance, mm-hmm. where people actually get together. Just the act of joining a group of people that are doing something gives you a sense of the power that's really there that you don't get from the media, which makes you feel like you're alone in this kind of idiotic thinking. And you know, there's no support for your own impulse toward peace unless you get together with other people and try and do something. And I think it doesn't really matter what you do. If you just start plugging into people that are doing things, you will feel an energy that you wouldn't really feel any other way. That's been my experience.
I can't remember their names, but maybe somebody else can help out. But I just want to point out some great examples of late of some people who have resisted. And who was that guy in San Diego who refused to get aboard his ship? That was because he didn't want to transport these men to war. No, it was he was a Latino, and I can't remember his name. Anyway, he did that, and he was very smart in his strategic approach to it, because he called a press conference and did this in plain sight of all the men getting on the ship, so there was these cameras there and these reporters there, and so they kind of couldn't do anything, if it had just been a private situation. So it got more media coverage because of that, and he ended up getting a very light sentence as a result of all that. So, and then there's been some other stories too of people that have defected or refused to go back and on the grounds of moral objection. So, I just really admire the people that are in the system and have the courage to break free, because it's really a challenge. Some people have gone to Canada and I just want to put in a plug for Democracy Now! When you all are back in radio contact again, if you're not familiar with that. Amy Goodman, she really tries to give visibility to these kinds of alternative stories, and so. So anyway, there are small things happening out there that are good.
Yeah, moveon.org is a really good way to get connected to what's going on. And you can do that right from your home, sitting behind a computer.
Yeah, just to tag on that, there's some big things too. You know, remember in the run-up to the war, Nation magazine had this cover, and it had a picture of, you know, a portion of the million people that were in Madrid protesting in February of 2003. And it said, the title over it, it says, "The Rise of the Second Superpower." And that was, it was really, I mean, it became very muted as soon as the war started and people have felt very helpless, but it was really encouraging how so many people came out and, you know, let their opposition be known.
But didn't they follow up with that in the election then? Because, you know, they had to pull their forces out of Iraq.
Just about to 9:30. So if there's something you're wishing somebody would say on your behalf, now is the time for you to say.
Would you give our grandchild a bath and put him to bed?
Thank you very much. I know Carolyn has brochures she's happy to distribute to anyone who wants
about this.
A little more information.
Display them here, if anybody.